Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I welcome you to this, the fifth in our series of 2018 Gifford Lectures. My name is David Ferguson. I'm Professor of Divinity and Principal of New College. It's my great pleasure to welcome you here for this rearranged lecture. I am particularly pleased to welcome a number of people who have travelled long distances, some of them from as far afield as Cape Town, Princeton, George Square, and Old College. And I congratulate you on finding your way down to the mound here. We have hosted Gifford Lectures in the past. I know that Reinhold Niebuhr delivered his Gifford Lectures here in New College at the outbreak of the war. I'm not sure if we've had any in the intervening period, so we may be making post-war history this evening. This, of course, is a rearranged Gifford. It's the fifth in the series. We're working Professor Augustine Fuentes very hard this week. He's already taken part in a seminar here this lunchtime, but we're delighted that he's able to reach his fifth lecture in the series tonight. It's entitled, Why Do We Believe? A Human Imagination and the Emergence of Belief Systems. As is our practice, the lecture and question time this evening are being recorded, and the video will shortly be available online on the university's Gifford Lectures web pages. Without further ado, then, I ask you to welcome this evening Professor Fuentes.
Religion, as we know it, is very, very recent, and we are not. Contemporary formal religions and religious institutions have concrete roots stretching back no more than 4 to 8,000 years. This is a mere blink of an eye in the sum total of human history. The distinctively human lineage is more than 2 million years old. And for more than 80% of that history, we have very little material evidence of anything like transcendent experiences and an acknowledgement of the supernatural, both critical to religion, and we don't see them as prominent in the lives of our ancestors. However, today, deep faith and devotion to religious belief are central in the lives of billions of humans, and the capacity to be religious is found in all of humanity. Therefore, it must have some form of evolutionary relevance. Can this capacity be understood as a central feature of human evolution? The anthropologist Roy Rappaport tells us that, in the absence of what we, in a common sense way, call religion, humanity could not have emerged from its pre- or proto-human condition. The sociologist Robert Bella, following the psychologist Merlin Donald, argues for a pattern in which religion emerges from the very processes of meaning-making that are central features in the human niche. Here, adding my voice to the analyses of Rappaport, Bella, and others, I propose that there are multiple lines of evidence suggesting that the capacity to be religious emerged in concert with the capacity for belief over our evolutionary history, and that religions, as we now recognize them, only very recently became a fixture of human identity. That is, for humans, having religious beliefs, or something like them, is much older than formal religious systems, structures, and institutions. To be clear, this lecture, in fact, the entire lecture series, is not about questioning broadly construed truth claims of any specific religious tradition, nor is it trying to identify some religion that gave birth to all or even a subset of contemporary ones. It is about why we believe the ways in which we do, which has implications for religion, but is not only about religion. I've spent the last four lectures outlining the evolutionary and material basis of the capacity for and infrastructures of belief in our species. Now, I'm going to attempt to draw on those and offer some insight into a question that most people actually care about. Why do we believe the ways we do? Or more specifically, why are humans religious? And why are religions themselves so central in the human experience? To be certain, I doubt anyone will be fully satisfied with the insights I offer here. But I do hope to encourage all of us to think more integratively and evolutionarily about this topic. Having said that, for the rest of this lecture, I will keep one foot grounded firmly in the material and evolutionary record, and I'll let the other fly a bit more far afield as we walk briskly through some data, a range of evolutionarily influenced ideas for why our capacity for belief has generated a specific kind of belief, what we call the proclivity to be religious, which in turn has facilitated the emergence of religions and religious institutions, both of which have had enormous impact on humanity and the majority of living things and landscapes across the planet. First, we need to make a critical clarification of the conceptual difference between religious and religion. Here, in the context of these lectures, I am using the term religious, directly borrowing from the anthropologist Clifford Geertz, to mean the use of one's capacity for belief in the context of becoming with particular perceptual, experiential, and agential practices involving the transcendent that act to establish powerful, persuasive, and long-lasting moods and motivations that may be, but are not necessarily, tied to specific formal doctrines, practices, texts, or institutions. Religion, then, borrowing here from Durkheim, is the formal coalition of religious beliefs and practices, rituals, and the material symbols and structured institutions that unite them into a single community via specific theological doctrine and ritual. As the philosopher Tim Crane puts it, religion reflects not just the having of transcendent experiences, but the systematic and practical attempt by human beings to find meaning in the world and their place in it in terms of the relationship to something transcendent. Now, I fully understand that for many theologians, philosophers, and many, many other scholars and individuals, you may balk at this division between religious and religion, and it can certainly be challenged under particular threads of scholarly argumentation. But please bear with me, because I hope to demonstrate that this is indeed a necessary methodological practice for an effective evolutionary analysis. Other modes of analysis may not find this as useful. A critical cause for this division in an evolutionary context is the relative youth or what are termed formal or world religions. Any attempt to describe the patterns and processes over the long durée of human evolution necessitates that we portion off large-scale contemporary religions such as Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, etc., given that the institutions, texts, ritual structures, and much of the content of their doctrines represent particular historical patterns and processes that are without materially identifiable roots or analogs in the human record deeper than the past 8,000 years or so. Contemporary religions as institutions are just that, contemporary. So, here I attempt to lay out the deep material record of human belief and place it in dialogue with the evolutionary-based hypothesis for why religious belief emerged the way it did in humans. I think it's critical that we delimit the why from the what here, because the two are quite different, but obviously overlapping questions. I do promise to touch on the what a bit here and there today, and a little bit more tomorrow in the final lecture, but I'm certain that I will not satisfy anyone who came here hoping for an evolutionary explanation of any particular theology or religious tradition, and I am happy for that, because I think such endeavors are pure and utter folly. First, let us take a brief history of the evidence for meaning-making and thus belief in human evolution. Anyone walking into the caves at Altamira, at Lascaux, at Leung Tempuseng, experiences an aesthetic draw, a sort of a transcendent shiver, even without knowing the meaning behind the images or the culture that made them. A similar experience is had when entering the amazing cathedral in Toledo, the Blue Mosque at Istanbul, the ruins at Borobudur and Prambanan in Java. In these latter cases, we are either immersed in the culture or beliefs of the creators and or these of these places or edifices, or we have some knowledge of them. But in the former cases, we are not. We cannot know exact meaning of the images on the cave walls, what those exact meaning of the images on the cave walls held for the humans who painted them. However, in both the scenarios of the caves and the more contemporary structures, the very fact that we are human enables us to experience some commonality of sensation and perception. We can experience that there is meaningful imagery and structures in these places and connect, even if just a bit, without specifics, via our capacity to believe across space, time, and culture. It is the human capacity for and ubiquitous tendency to believe that enables us to respond to the material representations of the beliefs of other humans. This capacity is probably the closest we'll ever get to time travel. The caves and the temples and the monumental architecture offer concrete material evidence for human belief systems. But most of these magnificent and often large-scale constructions are incredibly recent in human history. Before 65,000 years ago, we find no cave art. And it is not until the last 30,000 years or so that such art becomes extensive and commonplace in human populations. And let me bracket this again. Remember, I am working in a 2-point-something million year time frame here. So while 65,000 years might sound quite old, it is not. The building of identifiable temples, gathering places, and architectural monuments reflecting belief systems is even more recent. Only in the last 6,000 to 10,000 years of human records do such edifices appear. One might argue that this suggests that the capacity for belief systems emerged at one of these points, whether from a cognitive neurobiological shift or some sort of spiritual or divine revelation, depending on your philosophical or theological bent. However, as an evolutionary scientist, I know that it is not possible that at some point 50,000 or 30,000 or 10,000 or 2,000 years ago, a single shift, be it evolutionary or revelatory, changed everything in the world was made anew. This is not the way the processes of evolution work, nor is it what is reflected in the fossil, genetic, and material record of the past. The available data refutes such an assertion. This is not to say that major shifts and changes and innovations did not occur at these points, but it is to say that those changes are necessarily rooted in the patterns and processes of the bodies, behaviors, and minds that came before them. Belief systems did not appear de novo. They evolved. Evolutionary questions about belief and belief systems have to involve data. Let me be clear here again. Evolutionary questions. These are not the only kinds of questions we can ask, but they are the questions I'm asking. The key data for behavior from the past are left as material remains. So the first question we might ask about the capacity to be religious or about religions is there material evidence for anything like the symbolic representation or structured systems of meaning-making that religions represent in the deep past? And the answer, frustrating as always, is both yes and no. Let me explain. Material evidence of meaning-making would be in the items made that preserved across time. Because they are representing a meaning, they are what we call symbols. However, a symbol can only be accurately perceived and interpreted within a particular set of culturally accepted meanings. The Scottish flag means nothing without understanding the context of the Scottish culture and history. Those meanings, the culture under which it's created, is the context for which a symbol matters. Therefore, without access to the cultural context of the meaning makers, we cannot accurately know the meaning of the symbol. We cannot truly know what the Venus of Willendorf meant for the people who made her. We can make up a bunch of stories and explanations, as we are wont to do, but we cannot know what this symbolized. However, the biological anthropologist Mark Kissel and I recently proposed a way around the reliance on symbol in order to think about meaning-making in the past. To do so, we draw on the semiotics theory of the philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce. Peirce is most widely known for his development of the science trichotomy of symbol, icon, index. You may be familiar with that. But he has another trichotomy that we can use in this context. He also proposed a trichotomy of qual sign, sin sign, and legisign. And rather than going into that, for this discussion, we're just going to focus on one of those, the legisign, which is a sign vehicle based on convention. That is, if there are multiple examples of the same type of human-created material item that conveys or contains and or evokes similar or identical sensations, then we can say that it reflects a convention amongst the group or groups making them, that they intentionally are replicating the making of a material item with the same or similar characteristics and thus the same intended impact. That the legis sign did mean something to those who made it is evident by the repeated creation of items which evoke specific sensory responses across space and time. Thinking this way, we can go back to the Venus figurines and we can see that between 18 and 30,000 years ago, across much of Western, Southern, and Eastern Europe, multiple instances of very similar figurines are found. The figurines are not identical, but they share many features in shape, texture, size, and style of creation. They are replicas of a legis sign. They offer an indication that multiple groups of people were creating material objects that represented a shared set of sensations and or mutually understood meaning or set of meanings. Presence of legis signs offers evidence of meaning-making, whether symbolic or not. We do not know what these meant, but we know they meant something and that they were intentionally created by clusters of groups, of populations, of humans. So, how far back do we have evidence of legis signs indicating the possibility of a shared system of meaning-making and thus a particular pattern of belief? Well, the earliest possible examples of meaning-making may not be legis signs at all, because we only have one-off examples, and we can't tell if they're replicas. But they're interesting. Just either side of 1 million years ago, there is a bovine, a cow-like thing, a wild cow, of course, shin bone that appears to have a series of parallel notches in it. There are also two chunks of yellow ochre. Ochre is a pigment that can be used, a mineral that can be used as pigment. And both of these chunks of yellow ochre have evidence of gouging being part of the material gouged out to be used potentially as a pigment. We don't know what they mean. Dating to about 340,000 years ago, we have this. This is a clamshell from Java. Homo erectus, or something like it, took a shark's tooth and doodled on the clamshell. We, again, do not know what that means, but it is actually very interesting. Around the same time period, 300,000 to 400,000 years ago, we have the Behrakat Ram and Tam Tam figurines from North Africa, which are stones that are naturally shaped like a human, and both of them were then modified using stone tools to be slightly more human-like. Between about 130,000 and 300,000 years ago, we find other examples. This is a horse bone from Germany with etchings on it. You can see the sort of diagrams and etchings. These are not cut marks. These are not to remove meat. These are intentional etchings. And we also find things like the use of ochres more frequently and evidence of some groups modifying small stones or shells for use of beads. These are 140,000-year-old nassarius, which is a kind of snail shell, beads. Early examples of meaning-making in Homo groups are scarce. Mark Kissel and I propose that these are glimmerings, rare and potentially isolated occurrences in early human groups that demonstrate that those early humans had the capacity to create meaning, but that the context and the right set of circumstances and infrastructure for shared and sustained meaning-making was not yet present. But it was just around the corner. Here, it is worth taking a moment to briefly reflect on some incredible evidence for possible burials. Intentional burial is almost always associated with meaning and some form of belief. And we have two examples that are both older than 300,000 years ago of burials. The first dates to approximately 400,000 years ago at the site of Atapuerca in northern Spain, a location called Cima de los Huesos, the Pit of Bones. It is an opening in a cave with a long drop into a pit with the remains of some 28 individuals of the same genus Homo, of the same group, all lying at the bottom. There is no other way, and this has been modeled extensively, that aside from these bodies being tossed in, that they could have accumulated on that spot. And interestingly, amongst those 28 bodies, there is one and only one stone tool among them. And you can see the image of it right there. It's about this big. It's absolutely beautiful. It is an exquisite, beautiful stone hand axe carved from a multicolored rock which was transported from as much as 40 kilometers away. The hand axe was never used. It was made and tossed in. That's all we know. The second example comes from a more recent discovery in southern Africa, the Dinaledi chamber. About 300,000 to 350,000 years ago, a group or groups of small and slight members of the genus Homo, recently dubbed Homo Naledi, carried their dead deep into an underground chamber and left them there. The chamber in which the multiple remains are found is extremely difficult to get to. You have to crawl down more than 100 feet underground, squeezing through openings this size. So they squeezed through very small passages. They crawled, climbing, dragging their dead with them, and deposited them there. These members of the genus Homo risked much life and limb to plunge into the darkness and place the dead in a small chamber deep in the bowels of the earth. That's all we know. We do not know why the early peoples at Atapuerca and Dinaledi placed their dead in caves. We do not know if these populations were directly on the lineage to contemporary humans. In fact, we think they were probably not. But they were part of the human niche in an exciting period between 100 and 400,000 years ago when Homo lifeways were showing more and more evidence of meaning-making. At the same time, we know, as I've already mentioned, the inner ear and vocal apparatus for language had developed, and the neurobiology of speech was likely in place. In this time period, we see evidence for a substantial uptick in the complexity of lifeways in Homo populations across Africa and Eurasia. Fire use becomes ubiquitous, and there is evidence for the creation of glues and pigments and the manufacture of more and more complex stone tools. We know from the previous lectures that the human ability to imagine, hope, and believe was ratcheting up during this time period. The increasingly complex material items and the behaviors associated with making and using them changed the basic landscape of human sensation and perception. Many of the items, even the early human-shaped rocks, use of ochres, etchings on bones, they reflect the translation of inner sensations and perceptions onto external material items. They are novel imaginings made material, influenced by the material world, but not confined by it. The human niche was changing. More complex information was being exchanged, more types of materials being manipulated, and more uses for them were being created. More learning and teaching were needed to successfully become human. The ways in which human communities interacted with the world and each other was deepening in complexity, and the capacity for meaning-making played a role in opening up possibilities for human groups. By 100 to 200,000 years ago, it is extremely likely that language in some form and the developing imaginations of Homo groups provided fuel for the fire of creativity and innovation in all aspects of their lives. We have clear legend signs, carved ostrich egg shells, beads, ochre and pigments used to paint bodies and tools, and many, many more examples. By 65,000 years ago, we see cave art, and by 40,000 years ago, figurines. And the process keeps on going. The human niche gets more and more filled with the creation of meaning-laden objects. We see evidence of increased interactions, possibly trade, between groups, and of possibilities for more social and material connections across wider and wider geographies. More connections, more materials, more abilities, more modes to communicate create a process that feeds back in on itself, nourishing the fire of imagination and creating an openness to the possibility of a world that is more than merely material, more than the here and now, but one in which novel ideas and concepts can become material reality, in which hopes and dreams can emerge, where belief is both possible and necessary. The material evidence strongly suggests that it is in this time period where humans develop more linguistic and systematic modes of sharing belief. But is any of this religious or religion? We can certainly say that by 200,000 to 400,000 years ago, humans were occasionally creating material items and engaging in behaviors such as burials that reflected potential transcendent experiences. By 100,000 years ago, we have clear evidence that the density and diversity of such items and behaviors had increased and that their presence was becoming regular, even systematic, across groups. By 50,000 years ago, the evidence for directly representational art is widespread across the human landscape, and human groups are clearly engaging in symbolically laden ritual activities. And by 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, humans were creating and participating in full-blown religious institutions as we understand them today. Human religious systems did not simply appear out of thin air. They evolved. The anthropologist Roy Rappaport tells us that understanding the nature of religion and religious belief is about the nature of humanity, a species that lives and can only live in terms of meanings it must construct in a world devoid of intrinsic meaning. But He also argues that neither religion as a whole nor its elements can be truly reduced to simply a suite of functional or adaptive terms, almost contradicting his previous statement. The theologian Wesley Wildman asserts that abundant evidence demonstrates that religion is in fact at least partly the product of evolutionary processes, but he says it's a mix of adaptive and side effect features of the human evolutionary trajectory. And the theologian Wenzel von Huisting, just here, muses that religious behavior can never be disentangled from the broader issue of the evolution of the embodied human self. I agree. I do think that one can and should develop evolutionary explanations for many aspects of religious belief. However, I do not think current proposals for the evolution of religion are satisfactory at all. Most evolutionary proposals suggest that religion and religious belief are adaptations via natural or cultural selection to help humans organize into large groups and to facilitate cooperation. Others posit that the patterns and structures of religious belief are generated as a byproduct of the normal functioning of the human cognitive system, our neurobiology and mind. Such arguments see religion as sets of beliefs emerging from the underlying psychological mechanisms that enable humans to conceive of supernatural agents and then to believe that they are real. That the evolved human cognitive complex, our theory of mind, makes us self-aware and gives us the ability to attribute mental states to ourselves and to others, and to know that these things in others can be different from our own. The argument goes that such systems then produce mechanisms or processes that promote what is called supernatural agency detection. The creation of mental impressions, remember our capacity for detached mental representation, the creation of mental impressions that there are supernatural agents at play underlying many observed or perceived phenomena. The argument is that once we have belief in supernatural agents as part of human experience, the development and elaboration of a range of religious practices emerges as a logical and functional outcome from such beliefs combined with evolutionary processes. I am not convinced by this byproduct argument, and we'll come back to why very shortly. But another area that is actually critical for us to engage with is the notion of large scale, the evolution of large scale religions, or what are commonly termed big God religions. Most anthropologists and archaeologists see large scale hierarchical religions as a central part of the social complexity emerging from increasingly stratified social systems and material cultures, what we talked about in the third lecture. The psychologist Ara Nourenzayan recently has argued that belief systems that prioritize big God religions emerged alongside the initial increases in social complexity and coordination. His argument is that as these populations became more complex, their belief systems personified in the form of deities that are represented in their art and their ritual and other symbolic activities. Those deities became moralizing, interventionist, and powerful, and the belief ritual complexes associated with these big gods are what facilitated large-scale hyper-cooperation and coordination, which enabled the emergence of large-scale complex societies. For Nourenzayan and many cognitive scientists of religion, big God religions are responsible for big groups. That is, modern human hyper-complex social structures, including large-scale intergroup coordination, civil society, and large-scale intergroup warfare. Nourenzayan argues that strong cultural evolutionary processes have resulted in a system that links prosociality, morality, ritual, and deep commitment to development of belief systems with what he terms big gods who are powerful, interventionist, punishing, and require hard-to-fake commitment. He argues that because of these characteristics, the big God religions actually outcompeted all their rival belief systems and have become the dominant religions for humans today. This argument is also fed by a group of other behavioral scientists, such as Dominic Johnson and Jesse Baring, who propose that supernatural punishment is the key way to get large groups of human to work together and to cause conflicts between them, again tying warfare and centralized control societies to the emergence of large-scale religion. In this vein of reasoning, major contemporary religions and their tendency for moral policing and punishing gods are the direct product of evolution by natural selection for specific cognitive characteristics in humans. In short, they argue that the humans evolve mental capacities to create big and punishing God religions in order to be able to coordinate larger and larger social groups. Now, these arguments for big and punishing gods have become extremely popular, and they do make a degree of common sense in a public way. But as I probably don't have to convince anyone here, there are a few problems with these hypotheses. The big and punishing God scenarios overemphasize the need for human communities to develop new methods of coordinating cooperative interactions at large scales. Remember, intensive cooperation was already in place well before the advent of agriculture, sedentism, and increased social inequality. The big God story overlooks the possibilities that much of the infrastructure that the scenarios assume, hyper-cooperation, complex communication, art, symbol making, was already in place well before 15 to 20,000 years ago, and certainly was very well established before the 5 to 8,000 years ago timeframe in which the current big God religions appear. So, if this is the explanation, why didn't these religions appear earlier? Obviously, there is a connection between domestication, agriculture, and increasing inequality over the last 8 to 12,000 years and the emergence of contemporary institutional structures of religions. But it is a tenuous assertion to make the case that the big God's religions evolved mainly for facilitating large-scale civil societies, even if they do play roles in structuring and expanding them. The big God story is incomplete at best. It is not an explanation of religious experience or religion. It is one about the arise of particular kinds of systems and institutions, which is a different argument altogether. To get the emergence and rise of such complex and coordinated institutional religions, you'd need to have the religious experience already firmly as part of the human landscape. And that's where these hypotheses fall down. There are evolutionary arguments beyond the big gods and the supernatural agency detection hypotheses. For example, the psychologists Pascal Boyer and Brian Bergstrom describe being religious as the performance of rituals, more or less directly connected, more or less directly connected to beliefs about non-physical agents. Their argument is that as meaning-making activities and any concomitant ritual behavior become more common and central to the human experience, it catalyzes a more formalized religion. Now, the anthropologists Candace Alcorta and Richard Socius propose that differentiation of religious ritual from general ritual can be seen in the emergence of emotionally charged symbols. They argue that religious ritual is different from ritual associated with stone toolmaking or hunting or other behaviors in that it imbues the individual experiencing it with particular emotions and sets up the possibility of a more meaningful and potentially transcendent experience. They suggest that the development of brain plasticity and the extended human childhood is what sets humans up to be very susceptible to emotional priming, especially when we begin to be involved in the creation and participation of meaning-making systems. In this case, religious experience emerges from the human capacities for ritual, meaning-making, and expansive emotional engagement, and is co-opted by evolutionary processes. In these ritual-related arguments, transcendent and possibly transformative experiences are at the core of individual believers' experience of what it means to be religious. The cognitive, physiological, and perceptual realities of religious individuals vary quite a bit, and in that variation, there might be a complexity that is missed when the focus is on being what religious does as opposed to what religious is for believers. I don't think we can disregard the experience of the religious in favor of providing overarching structural and functional evolutionary explanations for religions or religiosity. The concepts that being religious is primarily a byproduct of the human complex cognitive system and or that being religious is an adaptation to enhance human cooperation are simply too shallow as effective ways to think about religion, evolution, and the human experience and leave out too much of the variation and the context of the data that we have available to us. So what I'd like to do is offer a bit of an alternative, working within what has already been offered and expanding it slightly. The anthropologist Barbara King suggests that the core processes of emotional and social bonding in primates forms the infrastructure for humans to be religious. As human ancestors evolved, the neurobiological and social complexity to think beyond the immediate present, their strong sense of belonging expanded into an infrastructure for religious belief. The neuroscientist Patrick McDermott argues that the capacity to be religious is a central facet of the neurobiological development of the self in humans. And the theologian and Gifford lecturer, Wenzel von Heusting, suggests that there is a naturalness to the human religious imagination and that it is part of the process that facilitated human evolutionary success over the past few 100,000 years. The anthropologist Rappaport, the sociologist Bella, the theologian Wildman agree. And so do I. In fact, Professor Van Hoisting recently summarized my take on the evolutionary basis for religiousness better than I do. And so I'm going to read that quote here. And I quote, "Agustin Fuentes and I, in spite of our radically different disciplines, approaches, and methodologies, completely agree that a necessary prelude to having religion is indeed the emergence of a human imagination and the embodiment of a quest for meaning as part and parcel of the distinctive human niche that has facilitated our flourishing as a species." Here, drawing on the past few decades of my own work and the work of countless other researchers, some noted here and many not, I propose the following as a complement to the eloquent analysis of many scholars on this topic and offered as my expansion on the evolutionary framework for religious belief. And as you know from listening to me so much by now, it's dense and convoluted, so bear with me. Here we go. By 1.5 million years ago, the human niche included the creation and use of tools, using techniques, and with a level of complexity that no other creature on this planet has ever matched. These processes and their entanglement to early Homo lifeways and their successes created a feedback dynamic wherein changes to motor, cognitive, and neurobiological and behavioral skills were mutually intertwined with and driven by the processes of creating, using, and sharing the practical, social, and mental aspects inherent in the processes around these tools. Around this same time, the developmental processes in our genus shifted toward a longer childhood phase with novel growth patterns, especially shifting the majority of neurobiological growth and development to after birth, distinctively unique amongst all mammals. This was facilitated by shifting patterns of caretaking and diets and the expansion of social coordination and communication within and possibly between groups and the deployment of novel intensities and complexities of compassion, heretofore not seen in other organisms. By a million years later, these processes, tool creation and use, elongated developmental life histories, and intensive social cooperation and compassion had become embedded in the genomes, bodies, minds, behavior, and ecological patterns of the genus Homo. Due to this, and over time, there was an incremental expansion in the complexification of the cognitive, communicative, and behavioral capacities of this genus. And by 300 to 400,000 years ago, significantly more complex lifeways and their associated features, which included fire, increased innovation, creation and use of more intricate tools, large-scale hunting, and more diverse resource exploitation, expansion of ranges and ecologies, and the initial glimmerings of meaning-making appear. This timing, 300,000 to 400,000 years ago, also maps to the solidification of our genus of the auditory and vocal morphology necessary for language, and to the period when contemporary human brain size is reached. The coalescence of these processes creates a fecund set of physiological, behavioral, and cognitive interfaces in the human niche, one in which the processes of daily social life involve dense social learning, teaching, innovation, and exploration. This is directly connected to the expanding neurobiological and cognitive, communicative, and behavioral capacities via a system of reciprocal causation, the construction and development between the material, the experiential, and the imaginative. Emerging from these conflicts of all of these interfaces is a more robust and essential human imagination, a capacity to engage with aspects of daily life beyond, with daily life and beyond, via social and cognitive prospecting, with such processes not limited to the here and now, to the material at hand, or even to a specific set of experiences any one individual has had. After more than 1.5 million years of evolution in the human niche, the capacity for transcendent experience develops and becomes a central component of the human life world. Over the course of the next 300,000 years or so, human groups drew on all the diverse features of their niche as a dynamic interface between the material and the social, the historical and the potential, the transactional and the transcendent. The evidence is clear for this. Legis signs emerge and the replicas appear more and more frequently. Toolkits complexify in more directions and at a greater pace. And human groups move more widely into new lands and mix more extensively, creating new ecologies, new societies, and new possibilities, continuously adding fodder for the imagination. During and because of this dynamic process, human groups begin to use and develop more and more aspects of meaning-making as central facets in their daily lives. It is clear that the emergence of language and other symbols, such as cave art, figurines, and a myriad of ways to alter the body's image and create new and deeply held senses of identity and community, is fully underway during this period. It is across this time frame that the transcendent and the imaginary become as commonplace, necessary, and evolutionarily relevant as the physical and the social in the lives of humans. Humans come to believe, and over this last time period, humans become religious. Remember, by religious I mean the use of one's capacity for belief in the context of becoming with particular perceptual and experiential and agential practices involving the transcendent that act to establish powerful, persuasive, and long-lasting moods and motivations, and that may be, but are not necessarily, tied to specific formal doctrines, practices, texts, or institutions. If one looks to the archaeological record, one can clearly see that this period is one of the major transition in types of meaning-making processes and patterns, a flourishing of material evidence of human imagination, of human belief. What is today prominent in all of our lives? The glimmerings of such capacities appear earlier, possibly much earlier, as in any evolutionary scenario. But the centrality of religious capacity as a feature of humanity solidifies during this period. And by the end of this period, say 15 to 8,000 years ago, we see another set of radical transitions in human groups. In this time period, we see the advent of domestication of plants and animals, of storage capacities, and the development of concepts of property and emerging inequality within and between groups. Increased sedentism, the development of towns and eventually cities, and the formation of large-scale multi-community polities, developing multi-level political and economic structures. Towards the end of this period, about 8,000 to 6,000 years ago, is when we see material evidence for the emergence of, and I go back to Durkheim, formal coalitions of religious beliefs and practices and the material symbols and structured institutions that unite them into a single community via specific theological doctrine and ritual. Or in other words, we see evidence, material evidence, for religions. This is how I think the capacity to be religious evolved and religions emerged, as a facet, a pattern, and a key process of the human niche. However, this offers no answer at all as to why any given religion has the particular faith, practices, and beliefs that make up its theology. That is because it cannot. Here's where I differ from many of my evolutionary colleagues, and am fully comfortable leaving the door open to the possibility that some form of transcendent revelation plays a role in the why answer about particular beliefs of religions. As a scientist, I can rule out specific theological assertions that contradict material facts. For example, the Earth is really, really, really old. There was never a physical Garden of Eden, and there were not two original progenitors for our species. But I cannot assess the veracity of truth claims about sensations and beliefs based on faith and the transcendent experiences that accompany it. The insights brought on by deep faith and devotion are real for billions of humans today. Billions. Social constructs are real for Holdem regardless of their origin. That's the whole point of faith, why it works. Faith is tied inextricably to the human evolved capacity or even obligation to believe. Belief is a commitment, one that humans evolved to make. Meaning making with the more than the material, the transcendent, and thus an openness to revelation and discovery, however it is experienced, is a core part of the human niche and central to aspects of our evolutionary success. This is why we believe the ways we do. Such a capacity has been, is, and will be a good thing for humanity. But it also introduces horrible and horrendous possibilities. In the final lecture, I will connect the key data, themes, and conclusions of the previous five to offer a suite of insights, possibilities, problems, and options for the future. Thank you.
I'm curious where you would place the notion of storytelling and then conscious history and placing yourself within a narrative.
So I intentionally, obviously, if this was fleshed out, the notion of narration and storytelling would play a central role. How do we, in fact, construct symbol? How do we teach? How do we learn? I think storytelling is at the very heart of human success, not just in the context of imagination, but methodologically, infrastructurally important. That is, early stories were probably gestural and emotive and physical about stone tool making. So I think from the very initial glimmerings of our capacities to move beyond just the material, storytelling has been central. And I think the capacity to do so using symbolic imagery and symbolic context such as language radically reshaped. So I think storytelling, once that linguistic component came in, the speed at which we could not just imagine, but reconstruct and experience the transcendent completely shifted.
I'm actually curious if you could say a bit more about what you understand transcendence or the transcendent to be, and specifically what data you would use.
Yeah, well, here I maybe rely on Kant or, you know, the idea that a transactional experience is the sort of interactive materiality of the experience. And the transcendent is a sense of the experience that is beyond not just the material and the physical, but beyond the here and now and beyond the contemporary present. That is, that you move beyond, outside of, and that you cannot explain it with the toolkit that you have for thinking about this. How would I measure that? Well, that's a very good question, and that's why I stick to the material thing. So how do you think about, let's talk about that clamshell. So 340,000 years ago, some Homo erectus in Java were obviously eating clams. I don't know how they got them, but that's probably an interesting story then. One of them picked up was probably a shark's tooth, based on the motion and the residuals in there, and it doodled. Now, this was not discovered when it was excavated. This was in a big pile of stuff from that excavation that people went back and looked at again. And I just did some recent look at some excavations in southern Africa in these big piles of boxes that were rocks that no one paid attention to, and we found three or four similar things. My guess is that in many places throughout museums, there are boxes where there are one-off or even some replicas of these kinds of behaviors. Why is that important? Because nothing else on the planet takes an imagining or some kind of mental experience and recreates that experience that's not in a functional way. Things build nests, things do incredible manipulation, the beavers build dams, but nothing else takes imaginings, detached mental representations, and makes them material. And so one of the arguments from the cognitive scientists is that that capacity, in fact, is tapped into a capacity to experience more than can be defined or described by cued representation, by the fact of any experience I have had or anything I've touched, seen, smelled, or felt. So I think, using sort of a Kantian approach, that transcendence is an appropriate term to deploy there.
Where do you see emotion in this model? Because it seems to be, you know, especially if we're talking about the difference between belief and faith, how does emotion fit into your model here?
Here I nodded to Alcorta and Sosie's work. Richard Sosie is an anthropologist from the University of Connecticut, does just an incredible work in this area. And his argument is that really some point in the deep human evolutionary past, this incredible sort of care, the compassion, this engagement, this capacity for deploying all of our physiological and cognitive emotional resources to care or to manipulating the world can also be then inserted or enmeshed in these ritual processes, in these processes that maybe were associated with meaning-making. And that the difference in these kinds of rituals or these kinds of processes are they become incredibly charged and more valuable. And the argument would be that this in kind, that emotion facilitates a movement from sort of ritual or engagement to a much deeper meaning for the individuals and an experience that is not just embodied, but potentially beyond the body. And so I think emotion is absolutely critical. Now, here's an interesting thing, because we underplay, humans in the world, underplay the depth of mammalian emotion. Mammals are incredibly emotive organisms. Anyone who has a dog or a cat or anything like that, you emote, you communicate intensely. Mammals are really wired to convey emotion and feelings. In the human, those have been canalized and targeted and really focused and ramped up around certain ideologies, certain meanings, certain affects, certain relations, and those then become incredibly powerful. And if you then cascade that in with the human cognitive processes, our ability to think offline or to have detached mental representation. So for example, when we began to communicate with words or some kind of symbols, many argue that the first things we tried to communicate were our emotions. And you cannot do that with the material here and now, right? We today, with incredible language, can't even agree on what we mean by love, right? But everyone can sense that kind of deep emotion. So yes, I mean, that's a long answer to basically, I should have just said, yes, emotions matter.
I was interested in your comments earlier in this series about other important belief systems, like economics, for example, but then also your comments regarding the importance of religion and religious belief. And the idea that, you know, secularism is something that's very unusual in the world today. And I'm wondering how those two ideas fit together. Is it that humans must be religious? Will there always be religion? And how do religious belief systems fit in with those other complex belief systems?
That's another six lectures right there. But the brief answer. So I'm intentionally using religious in a particular way here, and I do so with great care and great respect and great recognition that there are many, many more ways one could and should engage with the concept of religious. The reason I use it in a specific manner and connect it to the capacity for belief is that my argument is that I don't think there's such a thing as non-religious capacity individuals. That is a capacity of the human. That is a capacity that's tied to the human niche. But I do specifically want to separate this out from religious institutions as historical, political, economic, social elements. Because when we use the term secular and religious, we're actually not talking about experience. We're really talking about institutional affiliation and alliance. So no matter what a human says they are, they experience awe. They experience more than the here and now, and they have the capacity to let that influence how they believe, how they think, and how they feel about themselves and others in the world. You can't not do that as a human. I mean, you could have some horrendous trauma to your brain or something, but even then. And I think what's really important is when we look at some of the neurobiology, you look at it incredibly inhibitory systems like autism or other kinds of problems in neurofunctioning. And even there, we see novel forms of this openness to the world, novel forms of the ways in which humans can be more than just this. So that's the point I want to make. But I also think it's very, very important that belief, right? So that's the religious. Belief, our capacity to sort of commit, right? The whole to hope and dream and to sort of to take our imaginary and apply it. Economics is a belief. The world doesn't run on cost-benefit systems. We have believed that it does and create an entire infrastructure, making that very real for us. And so I think there's a benefit to partitioning these two things, even though they're completely overlapping. But of course, everyone is more interested in religious belief. But then we get, as you can tell from my perspective, this multi-layered issue of religions, institutions, history, politics, economics, the religious capacity of humans, and then text, doctrine, theology, theocracy, the entire range. And there is where philosophers and theologians can step up and start to really unpack the historical, textual, and faith-based contexts so that we can have real discussion about what these things mean. I think people want simple answers, and I can't see any.
Thinking about this, particularly in the context of other experiences of transcendence, like, you know, you go to a football game or a Katy Perry concert, and you would see almost identical kind of features of, like, that person's experience that you would, say, in a church service, or not, depending on what kind of church you're in. But I'm kind of I'm just wondering if you would see anything distinctive about the religious capacity in relationship to transcendence.
I think that's a great question. Just the image of the Church of Katy Perry is all of a sudden messed with my head. It's a great question, and it's very important because all of those contexts, people are reducing the religious experience to this broad-scale capacity for experiencing the transcendent or for belief. It's not the same thing. And so I would argue that that commonality in patterns, that's humans doing what they do. That's the human niche. That's our capacity for belief and transcendence in the imaginary. And we can deploy that in multiple venues, right? That's how we've made it in the world. But in the religious context, particularly once that religious capacity is engaged with particular faith traditions, with particular texts and particular doctrines, then you see a very different, that's canalized. So you could say, and many researchers say this, well, I measure the same thing, you know, in a Sunday church service and a football game. So yes, you're measuring the physiological component and some cognitive components of the human responding to very important, incredibly powerful sensations. But you're not measuring religion at the football game.
Thank you, Augustine. This is a wonderful evening. And following up somewhat on Sarah's question, I would like to ask you how you see the evolution of morality. And where does that fit in? You know, Frans de Waal told me a long time ago, and he's written about this, that he sees the evolution of morality as something that came before the evolution of religion. Reason for that being exactly that emotions are so deeply entangled with moral issues, and only after that was all sorted out, as we know, in early primates and later, did people actually develop, if you want, more complex notions of religion awareness. How do you fit that, and what did that mean for today?
So, let's see how to do this succinctly. I intentionally avoided the moral questions here because I'm trying to sort of construct this narrative, but it is an important one. First off, I would say that today there are moral systems across the planet. Some overlap, some are divergent. We cannot extract current contemporary moral systems from historical, linguistic, social, psychological, political, economic structures. Right? I don't believe there is this, as maybe Frans de Waal might, this sort of bottom-up thematic narrative that creates morality. I would absolutely agree what I said before about emotions in mammals. I mean, there are basic patterns of compassion, of engagement, of assessment, of the social contracts that primates have with one another that you might want to call morals. I don't. I would like to call them being primate or being a mammal. I would like to reserve the argument about morals, which I think is a critical one, to thinking about the way in which humans deploy them, use them, misuse the moral arguments, and try to deconstruct those based on their textual, political, historical context. I know it's a very hard position to take, but I am not sure we can learn much about human. We can learn a lot about human compassion, connection, interaction from other primates. I'm just not convinced we can learn about moral and ethical structures from things that are not human.
Okay.